Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do Rick Bayless, Ming Tsai, Naomi Pomeroy, and Wolfgang Puck have in common, besides being famous for the extraordinary things they produce in their kitchens? If you were to pose them for a picture, you'd notice that, like a surprising number of their fellow chefs, they are all quite trim, despite being past the age where youthful metabolism deserves all the credit. That was something Allison Adato noticed in her job as senior editor at People magazine, where she not only profiles the chefs themselves, but is often invited to dine at the restaurants that make them famous. So she started asking how it's possible for chefs to cook and eat such amazing food without putting on weight, and she shares what they told her in her new book, Smart Chefs Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chefs. Allison, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So lots of people would envy a job that requires you to eat these fabulous meals on a regular basis, and you were certainly not complaining here, but you have realized that the trends in fine dining these days do not make it easy to stay thin.
I think that's true. A lot of places, you know, I'm sure everyone sees things wrapped in bacon and sort of what a friend of mine calls ironic fried chicken. It's become so trendy, so maybe it doesn't have any calories, but That's, of course, not true. I did have a lot of really good eating opportunities, and I noticed, you know, if I'm going to keep eating like this, it's going to take a toll. And so I sort of wondered, well, how do people who are around food even more than I am, how are they doing it? How are they balancing their lives with their professional work and food?
And you made some rules for yourself when deciding which chefs to speak to for the project. They had to be reasonably fit, obviously, and they had to be above the age where a lot of people can eat whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, there are some really wonderful young chefs, both male and female. What I didn't want is, you know, somebody with the metabolism of a 20-year-old guy who can just eat whatever he wants, and by merely getting up in the morning, he's going to burn it off. I wanted people who not only had long careers and so had a lot of time to think about this question around food, but who had reached the point in their life where they really had to be careful about how they ate.
And each one of them, just about every one of them, told you they eat what they love, but it turns out that requires being a great deal more selective than it might seem.
It does. I mean, I sort of jokingly say, you know, it's good to be a little bit of a food snob if that means you know, choosing good food, choosing, you know, fresh vegetables and good meats and not eating a lot of processed foods. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that means never eating, you know, so-called junk food, but I think choosing from one meal to the next on most of your days, it means eating really well.
And a lot of them, you know, we think about chefs as being very adventurous with what they will eat and the kinds of flavors that they experiment with, but a lot of them are picky to the extent that they literally won't eat at all if they can't find something that appeals to them.
Yeah, that was something Rick Bayless out of Chicago said to me that, and you know, it doesn't happen very often because it's rare that he's ever in a place where he can't find something that he thinks is good. But, you know, he says his family will tease him about it. If they're someplace and he just doesn't think the food is going to really excite him and taste good to him, he doesn't bother.
And like many people, Rick Bayless, of course, travels a lot. And when he travels, he tries to eat what the locals eat rather than looking maybe for the fanciest restaurant in town.
Sure. I mean, he travels a lot in Mexico, and he's done so for so many years. He really knows great places to go and how to recognize them. But I think that's true of a lot of places you could travel, not just in Mexico. But I was in China last year with my family, which was a pretty big trip for us. And, you know, there were opportunities to eat really well, more like Chinese people were eating there. And then we also saw places that we went to that were clearly for tourists and maybe not as healthy.
Mm-hmm. Another major theme here is portion control and the idea that a little of a truly fantastic dish is very often more satisfying than a great heaping plate full of subpar fare.
Yeah, several people said this to me. Thomas Keller, we were talking about, you know, if you're fortunate enough to get to one of his restaurants in California or New York, you'll get a lot of little courses. You'll get maybe 15 very small courses. And sometimes people will say to him, oh, that was so good, and it was only 3 bites. Can I have another one of those?
Mm-hmm.
And he'll say, well, no, first of all, no, you can't, because you have the next thing coming up. But to his mind, that's, you should almost sort of, you know, leave wanting a little bit more of something, that the first few bites are the most satisfying, and then after that, you know, it declines from there. There's a big drop-off in how much you love your 14th bite of, you know, fettuccine Alfredo or something. That would be, you know, a big rich bowl of something. Do you really need that much?
Yeah, there's somehow that surprise that comes when you have this brand new flavor in your mouth.
Right. I mean, it's a hard thing to imitate at home. Obviously, nobody is going to make 15 courses for themselves. But, you know, maybe just making smaller portions and enjoying them more.
It is interesting, too. And maybe, Allison, you've had this experience. When you go out to eat at somewhere that is really special, you take your time. Sometimes by the time the entree arrives, you think, I feel full and I've just had a little bit of salad and maybe an appetizer.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I most loved hearing from the chefs, which I actually found really liberating, was a few of them said it, but I think Tom Colicchio, I remember, I think, said it to me first, was that he will sometimes only order appetizers when he goes out. The portions are more appropriate size for him. He maybe try, you know, maybe he'll order two, maybe three if they're very small, and get to try different things, which he likes more than having one plate of something. And there was another chef, a guy named Mark McEwen, who's out of Toronto, who said that he and his wife will sometimes split an entree, and that gives them a good portion size. And I said, well, you know, wait a second. This is how you guys make your livelihood. Do you really want to tell people eat only appetizers and share the entree? And in fact, they do. I mean, they're doing fine, and they know you're going to order wine, and you're probably going to order dessert, and you're going to come back to the restaurant if you don't leave feeling like, ugh, I ate too much.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. I suppose if you leave and you didn't have a great experience the rest of the night, it doesn't make you want to run back there.
Yeah, I think they would much rather have you, you know, be a repeat customer, try lots of little things on the menu, share something if you want to, rather than feeling obligated to order three courses every time for each person.
So chefs tend to really pay attention when they are eating. Can you talk about some of the ways that they do that?
Sure. I mean, one of the pitfalls of being a chef that most of us don't have to face is tasting. They have to taste their food throughout the night to make sure, you know, sauces are consistent and that they haven't reduced too much. They when they're planning a new menu, they might try possibly hundreds of variations on a single dish. So there's a lot of eating that doesn't involve sitting down and actually enjoying yourself. And several chefs said that was what tripped them up and caused them some problems, just dipping spoons into sauces all night. Michelle Bernstein, who's a wonderful chef in Miami, said she finally came up with an idea to use just a piece of lettuce or a carrot to dip into the sauce instead of a spoon, so she would have to chew it and literally tell her brain, you are eating something right now. Hmm. You know, pay attention. So that when you get off at the end of the night, you're not... you don't feel as though you've eaten nothing, even though you may have taken in hundreds of calories. And I think that while, you know, we as non-chefs, or at least I as a non-chef, I don't have that particular problem of having to taste. But there are a lot of opportunities in regular life where it's just a little bite here and a little snack there. You know, maybe you pick up your kid from the birthday party and they hand you a piece of cake that you didn't intend to eat. Just being aware that you are eating those things. Later on, when you have dinner, maybe you don't need dessert that night if you had, you know, cake at your kid's friend's birthday party.
It was astonishing. One of the guys you talked to said, yeah, on a really busy night, I might take in 4,000 to 6,000 calories. I mean, that's something that you can't, you have to know what's going on, and then you have to balance that with exercise.
Yeah, that, yes. And balancing with exercise is something that many, many, many chefs talked about very openly, even though it's not discussed. It's not, if you're somebody who watches Food Network or, you know, Top Chef, it's all about the wonderful food and not at all about what it takes to metabolize it. So many, many of these chefs are, you know, regular fitness people. They're going to the gym or some of them are working, with trainers. Eric Repair told me he hates exercise. That is certainly relatable for a lot of people. But at the same time, he walks to work every single day. I mean, rain or shine or a blizzard in New York, he's walking to work. So they find ways to fit it in.
It would seem like, I mean, chefs are on their feet for hours on end, but I suppose the size of the kitchen has a lot to do with how much actual exercise they get on the job.
It is. It's very physical work. I mean, even though there are some chefs, I'm sure people know, who do get quite heavy, it is a very physical job. It's lifting and moving and standing on your feet for 14 or 16 hours, particularly at the beginning of your career. when you're in the kitchen with, you know, by yourself a lot of the time. So you have to be in good shape, and I think that's what some of the chefs found. There's a wonderful chef, Michael Salakis. He's in New York where I live. He's at Greek restaurants, and he had, by the time I met him, had taken off about 80 pounds, and that was mainly because he was physically uncomfortable to stand for that long in the kitchen. His knees couldn't take it. He had to lose the weight.
So the timing of this book is really interesting because we're still sort of on the heels of the announcement that Paula Deen has type 2 diabetes, and there's, you know, everybody's had an opinion about this, and I wonder how that news struck you.
About Paula?
Yeah.
Well, Paul, I mean, first of all, I should say is that Paula is not one of the chefs in my book, so I have not, and I've not interviewed her, so I'm not speaking from any personal knowledge. You know, I think it is certainly good that she did let people know. I know there was a lot of questions about the timing and the motivation and she has a deal with a drug manufacturer. So, you know, I don't really want to speak to all of that because it's a little far afield from me, but I think it's, you know, definitely better for people to make the connection between the kind of really rich and, yes, delicious, but very rich food that she is known for making on television and the fact that she has diabetes. You know, it's certainly better to have that information out there and have people think about it, the consequence. How you eat does affect your health.
So some of the chefs that you're profiling here certainly do cook at least certain dishes that are just as rich as anything that Paula Deen would make. And one of the points that they stressed over and over is that this is, for the most part, it's special occasion food. It's not meant to be eaten every night.
That's right. I think one of the best pieces of information in the book is that chefs do not themselves eat the way they feed us.
Right.
If you were to, you know, visit Thomas Keller at home, he's not putting out 15 little plates of food for himself. he's not, you know, stacking it in a tower and making it fancy. He's making most days for breakfast a bowl of cereal. He's making most days for lunch a pot of beans, a vegetable, maybe a can of tuna with some olive oil. You know, very, very simple food. And that's, you know, it's liberating. You can eat like a chef without knowing how to cook like a chef. You can eat. Tom Colicchio makes for his family pasta and broccoli in the same pot, which is, you know, kind of how I do it. you know, it's not, this, you don't need to replicate what you see on television or replicate what you see in a restaurant. They are eating much more healthfully and much more simply than what they're serving for, as you said, for an occasion meal.
And a snack is like a banana or a handful of nuts, not something that took an hour and a half.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, nuts and a banana or one or the other is a great snack. And, you know, when you could, if it makes you happy to think about it, you can say, I'm having the same snack as Thomas Keller today.
A lot of these folks, particularly those who had lost weight, were real believers in the power of breakfast.
Yes. Breakfast is, and it's challenging. Chefs are not morning people at all. They work late hours. They often go out after the restaurant closes to a later restaurant to unwind with their friends. So getting up in the morning and first cooking a breakfast is not on many of their agendas. But I spoke to several who lost major weight. Art Smith lost over 100 pounds. Nate Appleman lost a lot of weight as well, up about that number too. And these were guys who not only needed breakfast, but needed a routine. They needed to be able to get up in the morning and not first think about, what am I going to eat? They just needed to know what it was going to be. So for Art, he has, you know, lost about over 100 pounds, and he still, while maintaining that weight loss, eats the same thing virtually every day, and that's egg whites scrambled with vegetables, a little bit of berries on the side, and some oatmeal.
My guest is Allison Adato, senior editor at People Magazine. We're talking about her new book, Smart Chefs Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chefs. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment, and we'd love your input. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Allison Adato. She's a senior editor at People Magazine and author of the new book Smart Chef Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chefs. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Just to talk a little bit more about the breakfast hour, Allison, a lot of these folks were major coffee drinkers, but had started paying attention to the calories that we add to our coffee with all that cream and sugar.
Yes, coffee is a big part of life in a restaurant. You know, if you work that close to an espresso machine, you're going to probably pull it a few times a day. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with coffee, and there's nothing wrong with cream and sugar in your coffee. But, you know, if it gets up to 4 cups, 6 cups, 8 cups, I think you just have to be aware that with, you know, several teaspoons of sugar throughout the day, several tablespoons of cream or whole milk, it does add up. And it kind of goes back to what we were saying about awareness, just knowing that you're having that. And if you don't want to drink those calories, to try to cut back.
I was reading something recently about these, you know, the fake sweeteners that are like milk that people pour in their coffee, mm-hmm. like Coffee Mate or whatever. And a lot of people don't even think about the portion sizes. You know, the portion will be a teaspoon, and most of us are putting three times that. Or maybe I'm only speaking for myself there, but
no, I think I think that's true. I think a lot of people, I mean, who gets out a teaspoon and measures their coffee into their milk into their coffee? I certainly don't. So I think just knowing that, if you know, you know, maybe measure it once if you're curious and find out how much you're putting in to get it the shade of light brown that you like, and then just be aware of that. And perhaps, you know, if you are somebody who's a 4-cup-a-day coffee drinker, cut it down to 2 if you can, or maybe try coffee without so much milk or tea, something else. Just, I mean, I hate to tell people not to eat something that they enjoy, because enjoyment is a big part of what chefs had to tell me about food. But I think awareness and knowing where your calories are coming from is very important.
Yeah, and one chef you talked to said she was retraining, or she had retrained her palate by switching, by sort of stepping down what she was adding to that coffee.
Yeah, that was Donatella Arpaia. She's, people might know her from Food Network. And she did. She just learned to drink her coffee without sugar. And I think you can do that with a lot of different... I've learned how to drink my tea without sugar, which took some time, but I did it. And it goes to exploring a lot of different tastes. There isn't just salty and sweet, although those might be our top two favorites. There's, you know, there's different types of lettuces and different that are a little more challenging, and teas that don't need to taste, you know, like a British tea party every day. You know, just challenge yourself and try some new things.
Okay, so coffee's a big part of life in a restaurant. Wine is also a big part of life in a restaurant, and that's a lot of calories.
Wine is a lot of calories, and as are hard liquors and cocktails. Mixed cocktails are a lot of calories as well. And you know, this is hard to hear, perhaps, but a lot of chefs have just cut it out. Drinking, going out after work is a big, big part of the social life of a chef, particularly a younger chef. They, you know, before you have kids or you're married, they're going out a lot, and they're having, you know, a couple bottles of wine or several cocktails after midnight. And many chefs, Naomi Pomeroy and I think Colicchio and Ming Tsai, several of them spoke to this phenomenon of late-night drinking. And eventually, you know, that's not where they wanted to use their calories and enjoyment. They would rather have a good meal.
And the ones that did still drink, several of them said, I don't have a cocktail, for example, before dinner.
Right. I mean, they're having wine with food. Wine with food is a very important element for a lot of these chefs, and certainly for a lot of us. They're not cutting out. Joe Bastianich, his job is to buy wine for, you know, the dozens of restaurants that he owns with Mario Batali. He's somebody who, I said, you know, when I spoke to him about it, I said, well, certainly you're not going to give that up because it's part of your job. He said, no, yeah, my job is to buy wine, but I drink wine because I love wine. I'm not giving it up because the pleasure of a meal with wine is something I want to keep in my life. Now, Joe is also somebody who's lost about 60 pounds, so in order to do that, he had to make changes elsewhere.
And chefs also told you that they did not feel guilty about eating what they loved, and that included, well, everyone in your book was in pretty good shape.
Yes, I think not feeling guilty about what you're eating is a it might be hard for some people to learn. There's a you know a real you know the dessert menus get passed out and people sort of look at them guiltily. Oh, I shouldn't, or maybe I'll share. And, that just isn't a concept to a lot of chefs, particularly those raised in Europe. A few of the chefs who are in the book, they're all working in America now and living in America, but. Like Eric Ripert was raised in France, and Marcus Samuelsson was raised in Sweden. The idea of feeling guilty about food was not really even known to them until they came here.
Which is so interesting because until very recently, there was not the kind of weight problem in Europe that we've had in this country for some time now.
Right, although I think we've exported it. I think we've done a good job of spreading it overseas. But, yeah, I think, you know, the idea... One of the big ideas behind the book is to eat the food you love and then to enjoy that food, not to eat the food you love and then feel like, you know, your punishment for the next day will be rice crackers and the half a grapefruit. It's just, you know, have it and enjoy it. And then, yes, maybe you're eating more moderately the next day if you need to, but not as a penance.
One pleasant surprise for you was discovering that a lot of these folks have a little bit of chocolate every day.
They do, and I said, you know, I'm down with that. I'm going to do that too. That was a very easy lesson to adopt. Dark chocolate is, I would say, the number one favorite sweet of most of the chefs who said that they liked to end the day with something sweet. Not surprisingly, Jacques Torres, who is a chocolatier himself, obviously a big proponent of dark chocolate, but lots and lots of people. Bastianich said he sometimes has one in the morning, a little piece. Instead of a cup of coffee, and why not? It's, you know, it's caffeine and sugar. It's not that different from your cup of coffee if you limit it, you know, to a small square. He's not eating a candy bar. He's not eating a Snickers bar in the morning. He's eating a small square of good dark chocolate.
Yeah, so this is not about raiding your kids' Easter baskets the day after. This is like really choosing the very best.
Right. And again, I mean, this kind of goes back to this idea of in a non-obnoxious way, being a little bit of a food snob. You know, if you want a piece of chocolate, give yourself a good piece of chocolate. And once you do that, once you say, I'm the kind of person who only eats good chocolate, the stuff at the checkout counter with, you know, the rows of packaged sweets, it's not even on your radar anymore because that's not who you are. You're the person who eats the really good chocolate.
I really enjoyed, Allison, the chapter in which chefs described eating like their families had eaten. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One of the things that I wanted the chefs to think about as I was speaking with them is where they got their ideas about food. You know, nobody grows up sort of waxing poetic about, you know, their mother's plain salad with just a squeeze of lemon. That's just not the food that really moves us emotionally. And so I was interested in what were the healthy habits that were connected to the food that we really care about emotionally. And people had some really great things to say. I mean, one, going back to Bastianich a lot here, but his family ate, they're Italian, they ate pasta a lot, but they didn't have sort of giant trough of pasta, you know, like the endless pasta bowl. It was part of a meal. Mm-hmm. It was a side dish maybe, or a little appetizer size dish. So, you know, he still keeps pasta in his diet. He also runs a lot, but, you know, so he's burning it off. But he's eating the way that he learned to eat as a kid. Using a lot of, you know, knowing where your food comes from is something Sue Torres, who's a great Mexican chef in New York, knowing, you know, she used to go with her grandmother to the markets in New York, and in fact, like, you know, live chickens, and they you know, maybe you're not doing that anymore, but knowing the origins of your food, knowing that you're getting a really good chicken that's not going to be full of antibiotics, that's going to be not only really delicious and satisfying, but very good for you, is a good lesson to keep going.
And demanding that you know where your food came from automatically knocks a whole lot of processed food off the menu.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Chefs were aware of carbs, but they weren't as hung up about them as a lot of us tend to be these days.
I think that's true. They are, you know, chefs are not going to cut out categorically whole groups of food that they need to use to create their menus with, that they enjoy eating themselves. This is their palette. You know, they're not going to just suddenly, you know, tell a painter, okay, no more yellow, that's it. They need everything that's available to make delicious meals. And so they figured out ways to keep them in check, to, you know, as I said, to not have a giant trough of pasta to sit down to, but to make it part of a meal. And that's been a big thing for me to learn, actually, because I have a young son, and, you know, pasta is a very easy dinner to make. But I've tried to sort of imitate what I see some of the chefs doing and just make it part of a meal.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that was interesting is that even though, as you say early in the book, we are living in the bacon age of restaurant cooking, meat was used in a lot of these families that they grew up in sparingly. And even now in the best restaurants, it's often, unless you go to a steakhouse, it's not about a giant piece of meat in the center of the plate. It's still used, you know, with discretion.
That's true. I mean, you know, Wolfgang Puck is somebody who talked about not eating a lot of meat as a kid, and that was in Austria after the war, out of necessity. It was expensive and just not that available. Meat is very, very available in this country. It can be had quite inexpensively. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. You know, certainly don't want people's budgets to be challenged in order to feed themselves well. I think that's the opposite problem we have, that, you know, some good grass-fed beef or organic vegetables is too expensive. But, you know, since we do have access to a lot of meat in this country, to sort of remember to use it more the way they did a generation or two ago, and use it sparingly, whether it's to flavor vegetables, you know, to use like a smoked turkey wing to flavor your greens, or to do a rice dish that has a little bit of meat that's more Chinese style. A lot of people that I spoke to are doing that and eating that way.
Mark Bittman had a clever idea. He calls himself a vegan vampire.
I called him the
vegan. Oh, you call him the vegan. Oh, okay. I want to give you credit where credit is due.
I don't know if he likes to be called the vegan vampire, but so that's why I felt that I should say that. But he does. He came up with a very good idea. He had put on a little weight. He had had some health problems. He visited a doctor about it, and what his doctor advised him, and this is very unusual. You don't often hear a doctor say this. He said, well, you know, you could reverse all of these problems if you would just become a vegan. Well, you know, Mark is a cook, of, you know, famous cookbook author and food writer. So never eating meat again, not eating any dairy again, is not, you know, not a real possibility for him.
Mm-hmm.
So what he figured out to do was to sort of be vegan until the sun goes down. And he's quite strict about it, and in fact, in addition to not eating any animal products, he also, I think, eats no white flour, nothing like that during the day. Once the sun's down, he eats what he likes.
Hmm. Well, that's smart, and I suppose as long as you're not just eating 1,500 calories after the sun goes down or something, you're probably okay.
Right. And, well, it worked for him. I mean, he lost weight. He reversed the health problems he was having. He was having, I think, sleep apnea. You know, that went away. So he was very successful at it. It's certainly something that that people can try, you know, spend a week eating that way and see how you feel.
This was interesting. You write that a lot of chefs, they'll eat treats, but only the ones they make themselves. So if they want potato chips or French fries or cookies, they have to have created those things from scratch and not just ripped open some cellophane.
Right. I think that is a really valuable lesson to sort of make our treat having a little, make them a little harder to get to, and mm-hmm. then once you get them, they're going to be even better than just ripping open a bag. I mean, there isn't anybody who likes a packaged chocolate chip cookie more than a homemade chocolate chip cookie. But it's so easy to get packaged treats all the time. They're, you know, they're at the gas station and, you know, every place you go. If you can kind of ignore those and say, okay, those are not for me. I'm going to eat really just the great stuff, the homemade cookie or the homemade potato chip. And then, you know, homemade potato chips, not something a lot of people make, and I didn't until recently. They're really easy,
mm-hmm.
and they're 1,000 times better than what you get in a bag. They really couldn't have been easier, so I made them for myself. They were great, but they were not so easy that I'm going to do it every single day.
Yeah, and I would imagine that they were not so easy that you just can mindlessly eat through an entire bowl of them while watching television.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, we made them, and you know, we were eating them as soon as they were coming out of the pot. But they were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was eye-opening. I thought, you know, there are certain foods that we tend to grow up in this country thinking of as foods that are not made. They just exist somehow, like a chip.
Yeah.
I'd never seen a potato chip made. Maybe that sounds very naive, but I really hadn't. I just, you know, and then I made them. I just, you know, you slice the potatoes thin on a mandolin, drop them into the oil, take them out, salt, and they were just heavenly. They were fantastic.
Let's talk about oil, because this was something that Chef talked about using in a strategic way. What does that mean?
I think it means, you know, using oil as a flavor element, not necessarily cooking in a lot of oil. So maybe it's like Wolfgang Puck suggested to me, steaming your spinach, steaming your vegetables, and then finishing with a drizzle of olive oil or a good walnut oil, experimenting with different flavored oils, because now if you're thinking of it as not just something to saute or fry in, but something to add flavor, you can really experiment and try a lot of different types. And that's, you know, that's where your mouth is really going to taste it at the end of the cooking, and it gives, you know, a little bit more bang.
They were not shy about using salt, which might surprise people.
Right. I would say, and this is maybe, you know, if the book has a point of controversy, this might be it, because I've already been asked about this quite a bit. You know, eat more salt is not is not a diet tip. Nobody's going to pretend that it is. I mean, you have to unpack the idea a little bit, which is that what I think a lot of these chefs are saying is make food taste fantastic. Make it taste really good and let it be really satisfying. That's how you're going to sit down and enjoy an appropriate portion and really feel sated. And part of that is seasoning your food properly while cooking it. I think Mark Murphy said it really well in that chapter when he talks about that you cannot simply leave salt and pepper on the table for whoever wants it and let them add it to your, you know, your cooked carrots. You've got to cook the carrots in some salt to get the flavor that is going to just, you know, be wow, and not just be sort of a flat carrot.
My guest, let me jump in for a quick break. My guest is Allison Adato, senior editor at People Magazine. Her new book is called Smart Chefs Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chef. If perhaps you are a chef or you have learned something from a chef or you have a question about how they eat and prepare foods, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is People Magazine senior editor Allison Adato, whose new book is called Smart Chefs Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chefs. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Allison, was there something else you wanted to tell us about salt and chefs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, look, if you have been told by a doctor to cut back on sodium, this should not supersede that advice. But if you, you know, if you don't have a real health reason to avoid salt, you know, then I think a lot of the chefs would say, why are you being so stingy with it? It really does change the flavor and improve the flavor of everything from vegetables to chocolate. It's a very, very easy thing to experiment with in terms of just an easy way to make your food taste better without learning new techniques. It's put some salt on it.
And they also were really big on bold flavors and adding things to foods that we might not imagine a particular spice or flavor going with.
Yes. And, you know, especially I think if you are trying to lose weight, if you've gone to that, you know, diet head where you're thinking of eating diet foods or something, you know, bland foods, this is exactly the opposite of how a chef would approach it. You know, you don't want to go for rice cakes and watery yogurt and stuff like that. You want to make food that tastes so good, even if you're cutting back calories and fat. And so using things like garlic and chili peppers and ginger and great one is smoked paprika. This was a little bit of a revelation for me. If you're somebody who likes to cook, you know, bacon with your vegetables or smoked turkey wing or something like that, using smoked paprika adds no fat. And it's, you know, I'm not going to say it's the exact same thing, but it does give that great, rich, smoky profile. And a few of the chefs, I think it was the Lee brothers, actually, who turned me on to that.
They're big fans of pickles as well.
And pickles, yes. Pickles are fantastic. I mean, you know, I think pickles count as vegetables in my book. and yet it's an easy way to dress up a plate. It's a non-fat way to dress up a plate. It gives you that acid, that vinegar that satisfies the palate and crunch.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we have Sandy in Fort Worth. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is, it's a very enjoyable program. I just wanted to share, I watch a lot of cooking shows when I'm riding stationary bike and what have you. I've learned so much from them, and they make it so romantic. They make it fun to watch, put the meals together. And so I've really enjoyed doing that more, and I think that's probably more enjoyable for me than actually sitting down and eating the meal.
Hmm.
I love using the different spices, and the smoked paprika is one that I've been experimenting with lately. But I love to see my family enjoy the food tasting so good and not using a lot of oil. One thing I've learned recently and am doing a lot of is sautéing my vegetables in vegetable stock instead of using all of the olive oils and making it really heavy. And it really brings out the flavor and crunch of vegetables. So I just wanted to share that thought, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sandy, thank you so much for your call. And Allison, a lot of chefs were really big on stocks and water-based cooking.
Yeah, stock is actually, I think Sandy is doing a great thing using stock. Stock has sort of two great elements about it. One is that, as she said, you can use it to cook your vegetables in or cook your meat in, cook even pasta or rice and give it more flavor. The other thing is that if you're buying more vegetables, you'll find that you sometimes end up at the end of the week with some odds and ends, and maybe something's gone a little bit limp and it's not maybe going to end up on your dinner plate. Make some stock. It's what they do in restaurants. They use everything in restaurants. Throwing food away in a restaurant is losing money. So making some homemade stock and keeping it in the freezer, even in an ice cube tray, to take a couple out and saute your vegetables in is a great idea.
And just so people don't get confused, we're talking now of stocks, but to go to stalks, I mean, things like broccoli stalks that a lot of people threw away for years and years turn out to be edible and really delicious.
Broccoli stalks are amazing. It is really, it tastes slightly different from the crown of the broccoli. You do have to take a little vegetable peeler and just kind of peel the tough outside, maybe like you were peeling a cucumber skin off,
mm-hmm.
And then just chop that up and either put it, you can eat it raw in salad or saute it in a stir fry or add to your steamed vegetables. Don't throw them away.
I had to laugh reading the book because I recently made that discovery myself, and to hear that you had done the same thing was funny, because how many pounds of really good vegetables are in the garbage now after years of not knowing that?
Exactly. And this is, I think, a great reason to turn to chefs for their kitchen advice, because they are so economical in the kitchen. They have to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Christopher calling from Southlake. Hey, Christopher.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Basically, I just wanted to say I am a chef, and I've been eating this way for years, and it's so hard to explain to other people, you know, when you tell them I eat what I like. So I think this book will definitely come in handy. I'm going to try to pick up a couple copies of it to pass out to other coworkers and family.
Great. Well, so, Christopher, are they all surprised that you are able to stay trim and eat what you love?
Definitely. I definitely have some heavier people in my family. So to actually be a decent weight is kind of nice.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones once again. This time we have Nick on the line in Addison. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I enjoy your show. My question is that we try to eat as healthy as possible at home, and we try to bake or make most of our food at home. But my concern is when we are making or baking something, there are these prepackaged items that are loaded with those bad stuff for us, like high corn fructose or things like that. But they're easy to make, but we can't start everything from scratch. So is there any suggestion that we can get something that is healthy and we can easily make make it at home.
Any thoughts, Allison?
Sure. I mean, I think if you, you know, I agree. I mean, I have a, you know, a full-time job and a child, and fitting cooking in is difficult. You know, if you can find maybe one day every couple weeks and make a few things in advance, I think is helpful, like stock, like, you know, even cooking some vegetable, you know, chopping up your vegetables in advance helps a little bit. And not aiming too high, not saying I'm going to make a recipe that I saw on TV and it's got 17 steps and 15 ingredients. You know, really, really simple food is what is, you know, what's in my book and what I'm hearing from chefs that they're eating. So maybe it's just, you know, a piece of fish that you can cook in a few minutes. There's a great recipe in the book from Eric Repair for chicken in your toaster oven. I was shocked. I mean, this is a chef who's known for, you know, a 4-star fish restaurant in New York City, and he cooks chicken at home in the toaster oven. So I would say not to make such a big production of cooking, and make something fast and something simple.
And there are some almost ready items that chefs don't necessarily turn up their noses at, including things like canned beans.
That's true, yes. Canned beans is a huge help. You know, if you're the kind of person who can remember to soak the beans in the morning and then they're ready for you when you come home from work, that's great. I'm not that person. I will open garbanzo beans and kidney beans and black beans, this is a great form of protein. Also, there's a recipe in the book from Nancy Silverton that uses canned lentil soup that she drains. She just puts it in the strainer for a moment, gets the liquid out, and uses that as a base under some salmon that cooks very quickly. It really couldn't be easier. And she also says, you know, a lot of the chefs talk to me about liking to eat roast chicken. She will sometimes pick up a pre-cooked chicken at a restaurant nearby her, a takeout place, and she'll come home and use that as a base for soups, tacos, chicken salad. I don't think they turn up their noses at that idea at all.
So how do these chefs, the ones who have families, how do they feed their kids?
It's interesting. I mean, eating with your kids is hard sometimes when you're a chef because they often miss the dinner hour.
Sure.
They're at work. So sitting down to breakfast together, is they make a point to do that, which I think is a great idea. If you're somebody who's rushing in the morning and then maybe gets to your desk and then you're starving and you grab, you know, something out of the vending machine at work, or, you know, if you sat down in the morning to eat with your kids, it can be done in 10 minutes. It really starts the day off. I found that it started off for me much better, and that's something that a lot of chefs are doing because they don't get that dinner time. And the other thing is introducing their kids to the kind of healthy foods that they want to keep in their own diet. So Kat Cora, who's got 4 boys, told me that she wants to eat fish and vegetables. That's on a typical night, or maybe some grilled chicken. She wants to eat healthy and simply. And she found that making them the same dish with like a dipping sauce on the side, she might make some, you know, a pepper sauce like Romesco, and putting food on skewers. It's the exact same thing that she wants to keep in her diet, but made a little bit more fun for the kids. So she's not cooking a separate meal of, you know, noodles and chicken fingers or something for them. She's introducing them to the food she wants to eat herself.
It does make me crazy, and I don't know if you've had this experience, Allison, maybe not in these restaurants of these chefs, but the kids' menus are so often, even in a restaurant that serves great food, they're so often exactly that. They're macaroni and cheese and chicken fingers.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And you do find them even in some nicer restaurants. You know, I know that there are some kids or parents who will say that their kids, that's all they'll eat is chicken and noodles or something. But I typically say no to them. My son is 9 now, but even when he was younger, we would just, you know, let him order an appetizer.
Mm-hmm.
We would ask if something was very spicy, could they keep the sauce on the side, something like that. But there's no reason that, I mean, kids are, in my mind, like people, but smaller. And we should feed them like people. I think a lot of the chefs are trying to introduce their kids. They're cooking with their kids. They're sitting down and eating with their kids. They're having their kids eat the same kinds of foods. But, at the same time, a really lovely thing I heard was from a few of them, including Mark Murphy mentioned this to me. If they're walking down the street and they see the Mr. Softy truck and his kids want an ice cream, go get an ice cream with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it wasn't his plan, maybe it wasn't on his diet today to have a Mr. Softy, but he really wants to raise his kids with what he called shared food experiences. So he's not going to sacrifice that moment of togetherness for, you know, the 200 calories in an ice cream cone.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Royce City is our next city, and we have Susan on the line there. Hey, Susan.
Hey, I'm enjoying this a lot, and I just wanted to make a quick comment about the salt. I met a chef in another small town outside of Dallas in Emory, and she said kosher salt is a secret for adding even better flavor than just your other salt. I didn't know it made a difference, and it definitely does. Have you found that?
You know, there are a lot of different salts that people mention to me. There's a salt that's made in England, or not made, I guess it's harvested technically, in England called Maldon salt, which is even a little bit larger flake. And it was the term that I learned was it's a finishing salt. So there are some salts like kosher salt, as you mentioned, that you cook with, and then some to finish with. And people are putting Maldon salt on, you know, on brownies or on little hors d'oeuvres or on salads. And it's a large flake, and you actually get that little crunch when you bite into something with it. So, yeah, there are a few different salts mentioned in the book that, and I probably could have put many more. People who are using truffle salts and black salts and salts with lava in it from Hawaii. I mean, all salt is the same chemical. It's all,
yeah,
you know, it's all sodium, but you can get some different flavors. But, you know, these salts can also get kind of pricey, and don't use them to cook with. I would say, kosher salt to cook with, and maybe if you want to get into some of these different flavored salts, just to sprinkle a little on top of a dish. Definitely don't put them in, like, in your pasta water or something.
But no chef sang the praises of, like, table salt, the kind that comes with the girl in the raincoat.
You know, it's not so much that they sing the praises of it. It's not. It's also, I think, useful. I mean, I think that is a perfectly fine salt to use to salt your pasta water.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you do have to make it pretty salty. A couple different people said it should. If you take a sip, it should taste like seawater.
So
if you're using a lot of salt, I don't see the problem with using table salt. It's getting boiled in water.
Allison, has it gotten easier for you to go to all these fantastic restaurants and keep your figure?
I should say, you know, lest your listenership completely hate me, that while I was working on this book, I had very, very few meals at these restaurants because in order to interview the chef, I had to catch them off duty. Very few of them were feeding me. Yes, I've definitely learned to feel a little bit more comfortable saying I'm just going to have two appetizers or, my husband and I are going to split an entree. I think I used to feel a little self-conscious about that. Like if I'm in a really nice place or a trendy place, and, you know, that's just opened, I think I felt almost an obligation to be a good customer.
Yeah.
Now I just want to be a good diner.
Allison Adato's new book is called Smart Chefs Stay Slim, Lessons in Eating and Living from America's Best Chefs. Allison, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show and download the free podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.